Welcome back to Bedtime Tea with Paula. I am your host, Paula. And today I have a solo episode for you. A lot of you guys said you wanted a solo episode, so let's try it out. I do have some upcoming interviews that I'm excited for, but for today I wanted to talk about a topic that I love talking about, which is sleep training myths. So for starters, when I talk about sleep training, a lot of times people, you know, get really upset with me. They're like, why do you care? Somebody sleep trains their kid. For me, it's like, it's not just about that one instance if the parent chooses to do that and if that works for them. I've said it before, I will never judge a parent for making the right choices for their family. But I'm always fighting against sleep training culture. And a big part of that is all of these myths that come with sleep training culture. All of these ideas about how our children should sleep, about how we should be managing their sleep, that I have seen hurt parents and children. You know, it's interesting. I was talking to one of my midwives the other day, and she was saying how in the last few years she's seen such an increase in parental anxiety around sleep, and they're having parents ask them as early as like 6 weeks, like, can I sleep train my baby? What do I do about sleep? And I really, really believe that a lot of this has to do with the sleep training industry getting bigger and bigger, people having access to way too much information online, and just being constantly pushed all of these ideas about sleep. Everywhere you go, really, like, I have pregnancy apps that are already talking about sleep. If you have any kind of tracking app or whatever, they start early on to tell you, like, this is how you should set good habits. And, you know, if you're in any newsletter, whether it's for diapers or baby PJs, they will send you sleep training tips. It's really everywhere, particularly if you live in United States and Canada. I can't really speak for the rest of the world. I know Australia has a pretty big sleep training culture, and so does the UK. That's where the majority of you guys are from. So that's really what I can speak to. But yeah, it's big and it's insidious. And, you know, there's, again, all these sort of lies and myths that are perpetuated so much that they've become sort of general knowledge and people don't even question them anymore. And as I always say, it's taking away from our ability to listen to our own instincts and to truly tune into our child. On episode 2, if you want to go back and listen, I interviewed Michelle, who is an expert in infant mental health, and we talked about attachment and how one of the key components of building a secure attachment with your child is attunement. So there's a couple of things to that. How can we be attuned to our child's needs? As part of it is really instinctual, and part of it comes through trial and error and observing your child and seeing, like, oh, this thing works to soothe them. This thing doesn't work for them. They seem to like it when I do this. They seem to not like it when I do this. They seem to respond to certain stimuli. That is how we build that attunement and how we learn what our child needs. The problem is we have all of these books and all of these experts telling us how to treat our kids, and it's taken away from that. And we're not allowing parents the time that it takes to build that connection, because it doesn't come right away. You know, I remember those early days. I remember my son being a few days old and crying, because my background is as an early childhood educator, and I always felt like I had, you know, I was good with babies. Like, I would go into the baby room and the babies would love me, but we're talking 1-year-old babies, right? I had never worked with a newborn. And you have this newborn that isn't even smiling at you, isn't even able to focus on your face, and you don't know them yet. And it's so daunting to get to know this little human and get to know what they like and what they need. But you do that through time, and it just is part of the parenting process. And I really truly feel we are doing parents wrong by not allowing that to happen. So the reason I want to talk about this today again is I just want to clarify some myths that I really think are causing parents more anxiety than necessary. And I hope that it's able to help you get off to the right start, or even if you are, you know, well into your parenting journey, that it helps ease your anxiety. If you like this, please do share with someone, especially someone who's just starting out their parenting journey, because if we can prevent them from falling into this hole of anxiety and stress about sleep, then I will have done my job. So without further ado, I'm going to get into the sleep training myths. Okay, so first myth, first sort of topic I want to talk about is timing. I see parents constantly stressed out about their kids not going to sleep at the quote unquote right time, not getting enough sleep, getting, you know, not taking long enough naps. And again, let me clarify that for you. So one big myth that I see a lot is sleep trainers saying 7 p.m. is the perfect bedtime for your child. There's literally no proof that that's the case. The theory is that, you know, it coincides when the sun goes down, and so theoretically it helps with their circadian rhythm. However, the sun goes down at different times in different parts of the world, in different seasons, right? Humans are able to adapt to the changing seasons. Obviously, in our day and age, in our modern society, for most of us, we're following some sort of schedule based on our jobs, based on school, based on whatever. And so 7 p.m. is a great bedtime for a lot of children, so that it allows the parents some time in the evenings to relax before they go to bed, and it allows them to get a nice 12 hours of sleep in the middle of the night, throughout the night. So it can be great, but it doesn't work for every family. Say that you are a family who your children are in daycare and you don't get home till 5:30 every night, and then, you know, you gotta do dinner, and then you hang out with your kids, and then you do bath, and by the time you get to bedtime, it's happening much later than that. And I've seen this when I've worked with clients. I've had families that are so stressed out trying to get to that 7 p.m. bedtime because that's what they've been told is ideal. And they're not enjoying the evenings with their kids. They're barely getting to see their kids in the evenings. It's just like a rush of go, go, go chores. And their children are fighting bedtime because they miss their parents. They haven't seen them all day. Now they're being rushed to bed, and it's just not working for them. Or sometimes you have children who have lower sleep needs, and they just need a later bedtime. And so it just doesn't make sense to force them to bed at a time when their body isn't ready for it. So that's the first thing I want you to let go of. Your child's bedtime needs to be what makes sense for them and for you as a family. That's it. It does not have to be 7 p.m. ever if that never works for you. It can be 7 p.m. if that works for you. It can be 6 p.m. if that works for you. It can be midnight. It really doesn't matter, as long as your child is getting the sleep that they need for their body and it's working for your family. So, speaking of the sleep that they need for their body, that is my next big myth. There is a wide range of normal for how much sleep we need. Even adults don't all need the same sleep. I really love to use as a reference the Sleep Foundation recommendations. So the Sleep Foundation is based in the States, and they have Listen, they have a lot of stuff I don't agree with. They are very pro sleep training, and we can get into that another day. But they do have a chart on recommended amount of hours of sleep per age group, and it is evidence-based. There's a lot of research that went into putting this together. And it's just a helpful tool to look at to see, like, okay, this is the average of sleep that people are getting at this age. Now, they've recently changed it a little bit, which is kind of disappointing because they used to have a better range. But they have acknowledged in the past that, you know, deviating from that average that they're giving you isn't necessarily a problem. So, for example, it says for adults 18 years plus, you should be getting 7 or more hours of sleep. We know that there are some adults that function just fine on 6 hours of sleep. Like, you probably know someone in your life who regularly gets 6 or less hours of sleep and they are just fine. And you probably know someone in your life who could use 10 hours of sleep every night. That's me. I could sleep all day. So it just really varies. And it's important to know that there's a range because it's so easy to compare with other parents and think, oh, my baby's not getting enough sleep. But the most important thing is how your baby behaves. So we're going to get into that in a minute. First, I'm going to give you the numbers and you can decide whether your child is fitting into that. So for an infant, we're talking 4 to 12 months. And it starts at 4 months because newborns are all over the place, right? Newborns sleep all day, basically. I know not all newborns sleep all day, but just you really don't need to be thinking about hours of sleep. So for an infant, 4 to 12 months, you're looking at 12 to 16 hours of sleep in a 24-hour period. Again, I want you to think about what a big range that is. Say you have 2 6-month-olds, one who needs 12 hours of sleep, one who needs 16. They're the same age. They're both within the recommended range. 1 6-month-old only needs 12 hours of sleep. That means they're not going to do a 12-hour night like everybody thinks is the best thing ever, 7 to 7, right? That 6-month-old isn't going to do that because they're going to take naps during the day. So they might be taking 3 30-minute naps, right? That's an hour and a half. And that leaves us with really only 10 and a half hours for overnight. And that might be a perfect day for that particular 6-month-old. Whereas the other 6-month-old, who needs 16 hours of sleep, is sleeping 12 hours a night and taking two-hour naps. And they're getting all the sleep that they need. And so I was the mom with the low sleep needs kiddo, looking at the other moms going, how the heck do you get your kids to sleep 2 hours, right? There was no way my kid was going to do that. He just didn't need that much sleep. And if he had slept 2-hour naps, he wouldn't have slept that night very well. And so that, I really want you to look at that. Like, the range is so wide. And again, it might vary even more than that. So the way they used to have it, and again, they've changed it recently, but they used to have like a appropriate range and a maybe appropriate range, or a recommended range and a maybe appropriate range. It varies. So they used to say 10 to 18 hours was the recommended range for that age group. Because we see that some kids do thrive on that and they're fine. So what do you want to look out for? You want to make sure, is my child waking up rested? Does my child seem reasonably content during the day? Babies are not always happy. They cry, they're upset, they're fussy, right? But are they generally content? Are they meeting their milestones? Are they, learning how to do things on time? Are they focusing on you? Are they learning those social skills? Just basically, you want to look at their behavior. Are they growing? All of those things. If there is a concern, if your child isn't getting enough sleep, you will know. You're not just going to have like all of these sleep that suddenly pops up at 2 years old and you're like, oh, this is why my child, like, you will know if your child is sleep deprived. Moving on to toddlers, which is defined as 1 and 2 year olds. The range is 11 to 14 hours. Again, the sort of previous maybe appropriate range was 9 to 16 hours. Again, that you might have one, 18-month-old who only needs 10 hours of sleep overnight and a 1 hour nap. And then you have another 18-month-old who needs 12 hours of sleep and a 2 hour nap. And again, they could both be perfectly healthy, normal children. So that's really crucial. The next one is preschool. So we're at 3 to 5 year olds, and the recommended range is 10 to 13 hours. So it drops quite a bit. My son is, again, on the lower end of that. He hasn't napped for a while. He's 3 and a bit. He's going to be 4 soon. So he's right in the middle of that range, and he probably gets somewhere between 10 and 11 hours a night. So he's on the lower end, but he's still in that range, right? He's not getting that 12-hour night anymore. He's, usually sleeping from 9:30-ish to like 8:30-ish. So that's all he needs. He's fine. For school-age kids, we're talking 6 to 12 years. The range is 9 to 12 hours in a 24-hour period. For teenagers, we're looking at 8 to 10, so 13 to 18-year-olds, 8 to 10 hours, which is important because that is more than most adults, right? And it is a known that teenagers do need their sleep. Unfortunately, a lot of teenagers stay up late, and, they're forced to go to school way too early, which so many people have tried to fight for later starts to high school. But yeah, they do need more sleep. And then, of course, for adults, it's 7 or more. And that's going to change. Again, it's going to change depending on who you are, your temperament. It's going to change depending on what's going on in your life. I'm 31 weeks pregnant right now as I'm saying this, and I could literally sleep 12 hours a day easily. So I really hope that helps to clarify that for you, and that you can feel a little bit better knowing that your child is probably getting enough sleep, just based on these guidelines. So that leads me onto the next myth. So this next myth, there isn't one specific myth, but again, talking about timing and scheduling and all of these sort of myths that exist around it, there's a lot of sleep trainers out there who will tell you these like very specific timelines for when your child should be on 2 naps and 3 naps and 1 nap and when you need to make those transitions. And again, that's something that I find extremely frustrating because it makes parents feel crappy when their kid doesn't meet those expectations. Again, as a mom of a low sleep needs kiddo, my kiddo tended to transition earlier than some. And sometimes later, because he needed, there's a big difference if you have 2 2-hour naps versus a kid who needs cat naps. They might end up taking 3 naps longer because they just, there's only so much awake time they can handle. So how many naps your kids takes a day is really going to depend on your individual child. I guess shameless plug here, I have a dropping the nap transition guide, and I'm working on a 2-to-1 transition guide, and will continue to work my way back. So I'm gonna read or talk to you about my dropping the nap guide just to give you an idea of how varied things are. Basically, I did some research on whatever research we have available that shows the ranges of when kids drop their last nap. This is where you'll see sleep trainers be like, oh, if your kid drops their nap at like 2, that's too early. My kid was 2 and he dropped his nap because that's what he needed, right? So I put it here, some kids drop their nap before 2 years old and others continue napping well into 5 years and beyond. The big thing for me here too is that this is highly cultural. You look at places like Spain, where a midday siesta is fairly normal. And it's also fairly normal to be out late with your family, where you have families, you know, sitting in a patio, eating outside at like 9 p.m. And children, you know, are involved in that. Whereas here in North America, it's like, oh my God, there's kids out past 7 p.m. Like, why are these kids out, right? So there's like, it is highly cultural. And just to say that there's like an ideal way to do things is so ignorant of what is going on around the world. And just, it really is rooted in white supremacy. Again, climate might have something to do with it, right? So again, places where it gets dark early, like here in Canada in the winter months, you know, it makes sense that you might want your kid to go to bed earlier. And so actually those kids might drop their nap a bit earlier because they're getting a longer nighttime sleep. Whereas your kids in Spain, Italy, those kinds of countries where they do have nicer, tend to have nicer weather, and they do tend to have a culture of staying up later, they might take a nap much longer into childhood. So I'm going to read this directly from my guide. A 2019 meta-analysis in the Journal of Sleep Medicine looked at 11 studies that examined nap cessation by age. They found that less than 2.5% of children stop napping before the age of 2, but not zero. Okay, that's important because, again, I know parents freak out like, oh my God, my kid is only, you know, 20 months and they're already starting to drop their nap. If they are doing that and you're not forcing it on them and they seem to handle it well, then that is fine. By 3 years old, however, 33% of children have stopped napping. So if your child stops napping between 2 and 3 years old, they're part of a third of children. They're perfectly fine. About 57% of preschoolers had stopped napping by 3 to 4 years of age, and 80% had stopped by 4 to 5 years. And again, that's not 100%. So there are still kids past 5 years old who are still needing a nap. And then the other thing that I found really fascinating, there's another study from Mississippi from 2002, and it's a smaller group of people that they looked at. But so there's 10,043 children, only in Mississippi, ages 2 to 8 years old. And they did rely on parent questionnaires for this. But what I found really interesting is that they basically separated between white children and black children, or rather what they call non-Hispanic white. So what they got a big difference between black and white children. By 8 years old, 39.1% of black children still napped occasionally, compared to only 4.9% of white kids. So a huge difference, like 4.9%, very few kids in the white group were still taking a random nap here and there, whereas by 8 years old, a lot of black children still were. And of course, there was a correlation between black children sleeping shorter periods at night and white children sleeping longer periods at night, right? Because again, if they are napping, they're probably sleeping shorter at night. And so that seems to be highly cultural. These are all children, same ages, same area, sun goes down at the same time, all of that. It might just be the way that their parents are approaching sleep. And that is perfectly fine. And again, to say that one person is wrong versus another, it's just being culturally dismissive. In terms of when children drop, say, from 2 to 1 nap, again, that varies significantly. I have seen kids as young as 9 months old, 9.5 to 10 months old, drop to 1 nap a day, all the way until like 20 months. That is the range based on the research I was doing recently for my next guide. And based on what I've observed just myself with working with clients. The most common range is 13 to 15 months-ish. But again, it's different for every single child and every single family. So that's another thing you can stop stressing about. You do not have to worry about your child sleeping, taking more naps a day than the child next door, or taking less naps a day if it's working for your child and your family. As we go through this, by the way, this is not an exhaustive list by any means. I regularly do this on my Instagram page where I get people to send me like sleep training myths and I debunk them. So definitely come on my page, usually on Wednesdays. Today I'm not doing it. I'm doing it here. But usually on Wednesdays, I have Spicy Wednesdays where we talk about sleep training nonsense. And I break down some myths. Of course, this is not going to be every single myth that I can fit into this episode because there's a lot. But again, just even looking at what we just talked about, basically just the scheduling stuff. Parents are so stressed out about this stuff. Oh my God. And then there's another crazy one. This is a freebie one I'm throwing in here. There's some sleep trainers. There's a handful of like Australian sleep trainers. I honestly have no idea where they got this from, who are telling people that there's such a thing as biological nap windows and that there are specific times of day when children are going to sleep best. So it's like 10 a.m. and like 12 p.m. or whatever. And then there's this big thing around like noon has to be like the big nap of the day. Like that's when your child should take the longest nap. It's so ridiculous. Like there is literally no evidence to prove any of this is true. And again, what is stress? I remember early on working with a family who had followed this sleep training program and they were waking their daughter up after her morning nap because she needed to make it to her midday nap so that nap could be longer. And it was like this whole stress. And I was like, wait, why are you waking her up? Like why are we doing this? This makes no sense. And they were like, yeah, they said that like she has to take, you know, a 2-hour nap in the middle of the day because that's when the best time for sleep is. Guys, that is ridiculous. There's no evidence for that. The purpose of naps, based on what we know, seems to be to release sleep pressure, right? As you go about your day, as you live your life, you produce stress hormones like cortisol. Cortisol is a normal hormone. And your brain basically gets tired and eventually you need to sleep so that you can release some of that and sort of reset. Your baby's brain lasts less time, right? They need to maybe be awake like for an hour and then they need to go back to sleep to reset again. That's really the purpose of naps, is to release that sleep pressure that builds up. It is not to be like, there's this idea of like restorative sleep and this and that. It's all BS people have made up. The point of naps is to release that sleep pressure, and every child is going to be different. Again, some kids are going to need that 2-hour nap. Some kids are only going to need 30 minutes and they'll be fine. And that leads me to another sort of myth that's out there, which is wake windows. It's not necessarily a myth, I would say, because I don't know that I've seen anyone really present it as scientific evidence. That's not true. There's a really big sleep trainer that seems to present it as biologically normal windows or something. I don't know. The point is, you might have heard of wake windows. So wake windows is basically the time that your child spends awake. And there are tons of charts you can find on the internet that will tell you, you know, for your 2 to 3 month old, they should only be awake for 60 to 90 minutes and then they need to sleep. So what you need to understand is that these charts are made from averages that people have gathered. They are not based on any evidence. They're not based on research. There's no meta-analysis happening here. This is just averages that usually sleep trainers have gathered or sleep consultants. And do we use them? Do I use them in my practice? Absolutely. Sometimes I do. Why? Because they're a helpful starting point for children where sometimes you just can't read their cues very easily. Some kids are harder to read than others. Some kids have the perfect cues. They'll have the red eyebrows just before they get tired and then they yawn and then it's like easy to tell. Some kids will go until they pass out. And so sometimes it is helpful for parents to start getting an idea of what their child's wake windows are so that they know when to put them to sleep. The problem is people stick to these charts like they are the word of God. And again, it's that stress of like, oh, if I let them go past their wake window, they're going to have like brain issues because their brains are awake too long. Guys, I promise you, if your child stays up past their wake window, they are not going to be harmed. The worst thing that's going to happen if you let your, I don't know, 2-month-old stay up for 3 hours, is they're going to be overtired, right? They're going to be grumpy. They're going to be miserable. It might be harder to get them to sleep. And now you have data for next time. And this is what I always say. Look at it as a trial and error process. You are a little scientist. You're an investigator when you're talking about your kid's sleep. So you see, oh, they were up for 3 hours. You know what? That was definitely way too long. But they were still doing okay at the 2-hour mark. Like maybe they do need a 2-hour wake window as opposed to the hour and a half that I was doing before. Let's try that next time and see how they do with that. Right? That's what you're doing. It's trial and error. You're not going to break your child. Again, the worst thing that's going to happen is they're going to be overtired. And if they're a little bit overtired, sure, it might affect, you know, they might take a shorter nap and it might, there might be a bit of a snowball effect, but you'll get back on track. So it's something, again, I don't want you to stress about. I always say it's a tool, not a rule. So if it's helpful, if it makes sense for your family and the wake windows seem to be easier to use than trying to follow cues, absolutely 100%, please do it. If it doesn't work for you, if you find that it is stressful, your kid doesn't fit the right the wake windows that you see in the charts, then don't do it. But the reason I'm not totally against them is because I prefer you use wake windows over like a pre-made schedule. Pre-made schedules are like the vein of my existence. I absolutely hate them because, again, this is my own trigger as a mom of a low sleep needs kiddo, where I would Google like schedules when he was little and see these schedules that were, you know, okay, at noon they take a 2-hour nap. And I was like, I can't get my kid to take a 2-hour nap. That is not happening. I can't force him to sleep. And so then it's like, what am I supposed to do now? Because now their next sleep, you know, you want me to wait this long, but they've been awake longer and yada yada. So the pre-made schedules, I feel like, are just an added stress. So I'd rather you use wake windows at least until they get to like the 1 year, not 1 year, to one nap. I find, and even for some kids, 2 naps is when you can start to, if you want, you don't have to, if you want, you can start to set a more of a schedule rather than going by like wake windows. You can just say like, okay, this is when nap time is, this is when the next nap time is, and this is when bedtime is. And that can be helpful because then you can help also your child's circadian rhythm kind of establish that. Definitely with one nap, I often say to parents, like, just have a regular nap time and a regular bedtime, and with flexibility and a range, of course, but rather than focusing on wake windows, because your kid's wake windows are going to go from like 3 hours to like 7 hours, and you're going to be like, oh my God, they're awake too long. It's fine. That's normal when they're going to one nap. So yeah, that's my recommendations based on that. I hope that's helpful. Again, just don't stress about wake windows. It's not worth it. They are not science-based. It is a tool, not a rule. So clearly sleep scheduling and like timing and nap lengths and stuff is a topic that triggers me because I've been talking for like 30 plus minutes. But let's get into a different kind of myth. So another big myth is that fragmented sleep is a problem. And I mean, really, this is what the whole sleep training industry is predicated on, right? This idea that babies not only should sleep through the night, but need to sleep through the night because it's somehow bad for them to wake at night. Babies are meant to be wakeful. Now, let me quickly explain something. We all, adults included, sleep in sleep cycles, right? And what happens is you wake up throughout the night. Everybody does. Nobody sleeps through the night. If you've ever worn like a Fitbit or any kind of, if you've ever done any kind of sleep tracking, you're going to notice that you wake up several times a night in between sleep cycles. What you do as an adult is you check your environment. You know, this is a protective mechanism to make sure you're safe. So you check that your outside environment is safe and that your internal environment is safe. So if you say have to pee, you're going to wake up and go pee. If your pillow needs to be flipped over to the cold side, you're going to do that. And most of the time, you're not even going to remember that you had these wakes, right? But if you happen to kind of rouse in between sleep cycles and there's an intruder in your house, you're probably going to wake up, right? So that's how that works. It's supposed to be there. They're for a reason. We all sleep in these sleep cycles, right? It is an evolutionary tool to keep us safe. Now, babies, and I'm not going to get into like the details of how their sleep cycles are different, but they also just, they have sleep cycles and they wake throughout the night. The difference is that they cannot meet their own needs. So if your child is uncomfortable because they have an itch in their pajamas, because their tag is scratching at them, what are they going to do? They're going to cry for you to help them. And oftentimes you're not even going to know why they're crying, right? You're just going to try and help them the best as you can. If they're hungry, they're going to cry. And they have much smaller stomachs than we do, so they need to eat more often. So it is normal for babies to sleep, to nurse throughout the night or eat, have bottles throughout the night, well into their second year of life. If they miss you, which is very normal as they start to get into that object permanence state where they are starting to realize like, hey, my mommy's not here and I like that person, or my dad or whoever my caregiver is. I like that person because they keep me safe and they're not here. Whoa, I don't like this. This is unsafe. I'm going to call for them. Any little need that your child has, the only way they know how to meet that need is through crying. Obviously with toddlers, they become a little more independent. They're able to wake up and be like, oh, I'm in my bed. I am safe. This is a safe space. I can go back to sleep. Or, oh, there's my cuddle toy. Let me cuddle that. I can put myself back to sleep. And so they wake up less, right? And so this is why your baby wakes up. The idea that your baby waking up through the night is a problem for their brain is absolutely false and an incredibly harmful message to send to parents. Now, when, and you know, I'm going to get into sleep training another day, like specifically, but what we know from sleep training, behavioral sleep interventions, is what we're teaching the child is not to sleep through the night. We have seen from actigraphy data that those babies are waking up just as much as the other babies. They are just not calling out for their parents. We've taught them, hey, at nighttime, you put yourself back to sleep. Some people call that self-soothing. I would argue it's just knowing that no one's coming for you. And that's obviously the eternal debate, which we can talk about another time. But the point of the matter is that they might not call out for you anymore, but that doesn't mean they're not waking up. So this idea that you have to sleep train to help their brain development makes no sense, because you cannot stop them from waking up throughout the night. Now, what can be a problem is if there is an underlying health condition why your child isn't getting good enough sleep. And that is, I don't even know if I can call it a myth, but just a big area that is missing in the sleep training world. Because sleep is being treated as mainly a behavioral problem. You just need to teach your kid to self-soothe and they will sleep. Except that is missing a lot of it. And what I always get frustrated by is that they'll say, well, you know, you should go to your pediatrician and make sure there's nothing wrong with your baby. Problem is, pediatricians are pushing for sleep training. Too many of them are. And so then they're telling you it's behavioral and they're not looking for the underlying causes. A lot of the work that I do when I work with families is look for those red flags and refer them to the appropriate healthcare provider so that they can, you know, figure out why their child is waking up excessively or waking up upset or seemingly not getting enough rest, even though they are getting lots of hours of sleep. Then they need to look further. And oftentimes, unfortunately, particularly again in Canada and the States, these parents are having to push and fight so hard to be heard and to get the referrals that they need. And it is so incredibly frustrating. Because more often than not, like, I cannot even count the amount of times that I've been like, okay, go see. And the parent, and usually the parents know. Parents have an instinctual gut feeling that they're like, this is not normal. My kid is upset. They're in pain. And their pediatrician will be like, oh, they're fine. You're just a first-time parent. You're just too worried. You just need to let them cry it out. And they push and push and push and push. And then they finally get to like an ENT or something. And it's like, oh yeah, your kid's enlarged adenoids are causing 90% obstructed airway. And it's like, we tried to tell you that, but you didn't listen. And that is extremely frustrating to me. So a big part of the sleep training culture that I have an issue with is that it's missing those health concerns. And the thing is, if a child has a problem like that, like where there's a breathing concern, where they have sleep apnea, for example, we don't want that child to learn not to call out for their parents. We want that child to call out for you because they're literally choking in their sleep. They need to be calling out for help. So I guess the sort of the myth here is that if your baby wakes at night, it's because they don't know how to self-soothe. That is just not true. If your baby's waking up at night, it could be for a bajillion reasons, like I just talked about, including an itch they can't scratch. I always use that example because it's just like, just imagine waking up with an itch in your back and you can't reach and you're crying, and your parents are like, shh, good night. You're supposed to be able to self-soothe. Like, that makes no sense, right? So if your child is waking a couple times a night, and this is my, because people always ask me, like, how much should they be waking up? We don't unfortunately have, that I'm aware of, good research to say what is a normal amount of wakes, because a lot of the pediatric sleep research is extremely biased towards sleep training. The research study that Candace and I talked about last time, they qualified it as waking up twice a night. And I can tell you that a 6-month-old, 1-year-old, even a 1.5-year-old or a 2-year-old, waking up twice a night is like extremely normal. And so it's not about, I don't really like to focus on the amount of time your kid wakes, but more like what are the wakes like and is it sustainable? So if your little one, say, is bed sharing, they're in the same bed as you and they're waking up maybe 7 times a night, and they're rolling over and they're nursing a little bit and they go back to sleep. That is totally normal. And most likely, depends on who you are, but if you're breastfeeding, you might not even notice that that's happening. You might just be like, or you might like notice them, you know, latching, and then you go back to sleep yourself. Totally fine. If that's sustainable for you, there's nothing wrong with that. There's nothing you need to change. If you're like, I am at my wit's end, they are suckling, there's a lot of suckling for comfort, which makes me in pain or makes me uncomfortable, then we can change that, right? There's things you can do to help your child transition away from it without having to leave them to cry alone. If your child, you know, you have a toddler, if you're telling me, oh, my toddler still wakes up once a night, I'd be like, okay, are they waking up and just kind of like they need a pat and a shush or a cuddle and they go back to sleep? Yeah, okay, then that's normal. If you're telling me your child's waking up and they're up for 2 hours in the middle of the night, or they're throwing like a fit because they are so uncomfortable and you can't figure out what's wrong, then we need to look into that a little bit more, right? There could be something going on. So a quick rundown, I guess, of things that could affect sleep that are medical. Airway, again, is a big one. So sleep apnea, you know, enlarged adenoids, tongue ties, any kind of oral restrictions can affect sleep because it can affect the airway. Gas, indigestion, eczema, a lot of these things are related to each other. Body discomfort, a lot of babies, especially in this day and age, have a lot of tension in their body, and a lot of that has to do with our lifestyles and how we are during our pregnancies. We're not moving as much as we used to. But the way baby is born is affecting, could be affecting their body tension. So it is more likely for a child who is born via C-section to have some body tension and need a little bit of body work than a baby who was born through vaginal canal. But even so, if a baby was, say, stuck in the vaginal canal, that could also affect, you know, their whether they're tense or not. We talked about this a little bit in the first episode with Dr. Bonnie. There's a lot of things that could be affecting sleep. So those are some of the big ones that I notice. And then they could just be like regular everyday things. Teething, Which another myth is teething shouldn't affect your kid's sleep. Teething hurts. At least it did for me. I remember when I got my wisdom teeth and it hurt. Okay. For some people, they don't feel it. Some kids are like immune to it. I've had parents who are like, oh yeah, they popped a tooth. I didn't even realize. And I'm like, oh, nice for you. My kid will be like in pain for 2-3 weeks for every tooth, right? Every kid is different. So some kids are more sensitive to that. Colds, of course, any type of sickness. When they go through growth spurts, your child might want to eat a lot through the night, and they might also need to sleep more through the day. So that can happen. If they're going through a major milestone, like learning to walk, learning, having a burst in language, that can affect their sleep as well, because their brains are just in overdrive. There's so much going on. They wake up in the middle of the night, they're like, hey, let me practice this cool new skill that I learned earlier. Sometimes you have, what else? I'm trying to think of like other examples of things that can happen. There's just a ton. And then the other thing that plays a factor is temperament. There are some kids that are just more easygoing and they just don't get bothered by the stimuli that other kids get bothered by. My son, for example, is extremely sensitive to sound. Surprisingly, he sleeps quite deeply, doesn't get really startled much. But if he was in a transition, like he was transitioning from one sleep cycle to the next and there was a loud noise, 100% he would come to me and be like freaking out because he does not like loud noises. Whereas another kid might not care. Some kids need more proprioception during the day. They need more activity. They need more pressure to feel relaxed. And we're going to talk about that in my next episode, where I'm going to chat with Candace, who's an OT. We're going to talk about sensory needs. But there's so many things. So if your child is waking up at night, it has nothing to do with whether or not you taught them to self-soothe, which I would argue is not even a skill that you can teach a child. Okay. Those are some of my big ones. Another myth I have is nursing to sleep is a bad habit. Bad habits, crutches, like this is a big thing in the sleep training world, okay? And makes me flipping crazy. So the whole idea is that if your baby falls asleep in any way in which you're supporting them, they are going to need that every time they wake up throughout the night. That is just not true. Can it be the case sometimes that, yeah, like your child prefers to fall asleep at the breast, that they might need that throughout the night? But that's not because you're nursing them to sleep. That's just because they're a baby and they would prefer to be nursed to sleep. You know, my son was always nursed to sleep. I mean, I use him as an example, and I understand that, you know, this is an N of one. It's not like based on research, but I see this with my clients every day. He was nursed to sleep and he slept through the night still. Whenever he started sleeping through the night around like 2, and you know, he's almost 4 and he still wakes up occasionally, but most of the time he sleeps through, you know, now he's not nursed anymore. But the point is, when he was nursed to sleep, he wasn't waking up every time needing to nurse. He was waking up because he needed to wake up. Sometimes he needed to nurse, sometimes he didn't. If it was true that the way they fall asleep is the way they expect to get back to sleep every time, your child would be waking up every hour because they would be waking up after every sleep cycle. And most kids are not doing that. And if your child is waking up every hour, that is usually a sign that there's something else going on. So yeah, this idea that you need to teach them to connect sleep cycles on their own. Again, that's just BS. If they have a need, they have a need. You can't teach them to not have needs, right? So that's a big one. And nursing to sleep is the most natural thing. Nursing naturally makes you sleepy as a parent. And it makes your child sleepy. It's been shown that breast milk has different hormones throughout the day. So generally at night you have more prolactin and then there's melatonin in there. And so it's helping your baby fall asleep. Whereas your breast milk composition during the day is different. And so it is normal for your child to fall asleep at the breast. It does not mean they're not getting a good feed. It does not mean they're lazy. It does not mean you're doing something wrong. It is just a normal thing. And it is fine if that doesn't happen, right? It's fine if your child's formula fed or bottle fed or they just don't fall asleep at the breast. My son didn't for a long time. He didn't until he was older. That's totally fine. But it is not a bad habit. Now, this is definitely a topic that I'm going to get into further in the future again. I feel like I keep saying that. I'm sorry, guys. There's so much I want to talk to you about. But bed sharing is highly demonized in our Western culture. And we are seeing data, mainly right now coming out of the UK, because America and Canada are not very good at examining the data, that it is unsafe bed sharing that is risky, not all bed sharing. So my biggest thing is letting parents know that there are ways to bed share safely. You can make it safer. And for that, I highly recommend the book Safe Infant Sleep by Professor James McKenna. That's probably the best resource you can get to. But I'll have more episodes coming up on that. But the point is that you can do it safely. And the biggest thing I want people to know is that I think it is ideal for you to set yourself up with a safe bed sharing space, even if you never plan to bed share. Because what happened to me and what happens to so many people that I talk to is that I was so adamantly against bed sharing. I was like, my baby has to sleep in a crib. That's the only way. And I would get up in the middle of the night and I would sit on my bed or sit on the sofa and I would nurse him and he would fall asleep and I would fall asleep because breastfeeding makes you sleepy. It makes you relax. It releases oxytocin. And so I would fall asleep with him in the most unsafe positions. There is nothing less safe than falling asleep with your baby on a chair or a sofa or even sitting up on a bed that's not set up safely. We had it all. I had my son fall off the bed at 3 months old because I fell asleep nursing him. I had him one time under the cover because I had fallen asleep with him again, nursing him, and like he was completely covered by a thick duvet. Thank goodness nothing happened to him. But that is so much more unsafe than if I had been shown how I could make bed sharing safe. So it's just really something I'm passionate about to make sure people understand that, because tragedies do happen and it isn't always preventable, but you can do things to make it safer. And abstinence-only education is not helping parents. It is causing them shame. It is causing them anxiety. You know, I had a fairly quote unquote easy baby in the grand scheme of things, but there are babies who are, you know, they call them barnacle babies. Like they just will stick to you. They will not sleep unless they are on you. And the options shouldn't be just sleep train. You should have an option to safely co-sleep with your child. And so again, I don't want you to just take this and be like, great, Paula's telling me I can bed share. Please do your research. And I'm going to have episodes coming up on that. So do read Safe Infant Sleep. But my point is that this is a big myth that is perpetuated. Okay. Last myth I have for you today, and we're coming up on the hour mark. So look at that. Is that every child needs a long, unwinding bedtime routine. They need to have a warm bath, and then they need to read books and have quiet time and blah, blah, blah. That does not work for every child. This goes back to sensory needs. It goes back to temperament. Goes back to a lot of things. Parents are always shocked when I recommend rough and tumble play or any kind of play during bedtime. And I usually do so based on what they tell me about their child. And they'll be like, you know, and it's often stereotypically, but it's often the dads that look at me like, oh, I'm allowed to do that. I'm allowed to rough and tumble with them. And the mom is sitting there like, because they've been nagging them this whole time not to get the kids riled up before bed. Listen, sometimes kids need that. They need to get that energy out at the end of the day. That play is so good for them. And for honestly most kids, unless, you know, they, some kids do get really hyped up and they need that time to downregulate, but that doesn't mean you can't bring joy and play into your bedtime routine. Excuse me, it doesn't have to be boring. It can just be fun, because when do you feel safest? When do you feel relaxed? When you're having fun, when you're happy, when you're sharing with people you love. Nobody feels good when they're being forced into a boring routine, right? So think about that. Make bedtime fun. Make it, make it a connected time for your child. And also, yeah, consider, like, if your child is, like, super restless every time you put them to bed and you're always fighting with them because they're kicking and bouncing off the walls, I can almost guarantee you, if you add some intentional rough and tumble play before bed, it'll make your life easier. Try it tonight and let me know, because I swear this happens in our family too, where my son, sometimes there's days where he can like just go to bed and be fine, and then there's days where he's just wired up, often depends on what he did that day. And I'll literally just be like, okay, run up and down, you know, I'll make him run up and down the house, or I'll have him jump on our bed, or he'll play, he'll do some wrestling with his dad, and you can almost see him like just calm down, and then bedtime is a million times easier. It is not worth it to fight with a child who doesn't want to sleep. It's just not worth it, guys. Like, please don't spend an hour fighting your child to go to sleep. Just abort mission, go back, do something else, come back to it later, or try changing it up, try adding an activity, try doing things differently, because again, everybody is different. So yeah, if you follow me on Instagram, you know, some of my most common sayings are, every child is different. It depends. It depends on temperament. What's my other one? If it ain't broke, don't fix it. And sleep is not linear. That is a big one. Sleep changes for lots of different reasons, which we've talked about. So, I threw a lot at you in an hour. I hope that was helpful. I hope you learned something. I hope you feel a little more relaxed about your kid's sleep. If you already knew all of this, it's probably because you've been following me a while. but if not, yeah. So just let me know. Let me know what you think. Let me know if you learned anything new about your child, if any of these things helped you. I just hope every single person has access to this information. So please do share. Not because I want to be famous, but because I want you to share this information with new parents so that they don't fall into that trap. So they don't have to spend their newborn days rocking, you know, and forcing their baby to try to sleep drowsy but awake in a bed. Oh, I didn't do drowsy but awake. That's okay. It goes under the same stuff. We'll talk about it another time. Yeah, next episode will be drowsy but awake, eat, play, sleep, all that nonsense. But yeah, just, I want parents to have this from the get-go so that they can have a more relaxed, more intuitive, more unique experience with their child and get to know their individual child. So thank you again for listening. You didn't have to make it this far, but you did, which means you're a real one. So I love you. I appreciate you. And I hope you get good sleep. May your sleep be good. May your coffee be strong. And I'll catch you in the next one.